Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1960, Georgiann Thomas was 18 years old and headed to college in Atlanta, Georgia. Georgiann is Black. She grew up in Gary, Indiana, and she says she didn't think too much about race at the time. She had Black and white friends at school. She knew Black families and white families in her neighborhood in Gary. Atlanta was different. Georgiann's mother went to Spelman College, a historically Black college for women, so Georgiann went there too. And in September of 1960, she got on the train from Gary to Atlanta. She traveled alone. And when she got off the train, a woman from the college who was supposed to meet her at the station wasn't there. So Georgiann took a peek inside the waiting room.
And I see a man in there mopping the floor, a white man mopping the floor in the waiting room. I never saw the sign, or did see the sign. It said colored and white, which had no bearing on me because I had never seen a colored and white sign, and it didn't have any impact because my mom forgot to give me the, as the young people say, the 411. I missed it. And so I proceeded to open the door, and he looked at me with such astonishment. I can just see his face to this day. And there was, at the same time, the Spelman woman who had come to meet me said, "Georgiann, you can't go in there." I was just so put out with that. Just on my first time down south, I could not believe I was having to deal with something like that. It didn't make sense to me.
Then Georgiann and the Spelman representative made their way to campus, but they could not take a taxi. They had to travel in another way.
The jitney was for colored people. You couldn't ride in a taxi. So there were people who got together and had, I guess, a business. And it was called the jitney. And the jitney took us on campus.
Now, transition to college life isn't easy now. And it wasn't easy then. It was even harder for Georgiann, given the culture and political shock she was feeling. She was getting homesick. So later in her first week at Spelman, she decided to go to Woolworth and have a hot dog, which was one of her favorite things to do at home in Gary.
But they told me I couldn't go. I had to go to the back door. I could not go in the front door, and I couldn't sit at the counter. And I tell you, I was just dumbfounded that I could not sit at the counter of the Woolworth to get a hot dog and a drink. And I had been doing this most of my little life. So right away, I was just blown away.
Not long after, something changed for Georgiann in a conversation with another student, Herschel Sullivan Chaloner.
She came to one of the student movements and said, "You have to do this. We have to make a change. We cannot allow things to happen." And I said, "I am going to do it."
Chaloner recruited Georgiann Thomas to join the civil rights movement. In 1960 in Atlanta, she marched, often facing danger. A white man burned her with a cigarette, and she had several run-ins with the Ku Klux Klan. But still, she marched. Georgiann was in Atlanta, after all, cradle of the civil rights movement. In that same year, 1960, Dr. Martin Luther King had just become co-pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, a mere 3 miles from where Georgiann Thomas was studying at Spelman.
Came to the point after saying our God is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, but if he doesn't deliver us, we still are not going to bow. But if not, do you get that? And these men were saying that our faith is so deep and that we've found something so dear and so precious that nothing can turn us away from it.
Dr. King delivering his But If Not sermon at Ebenezer Baptist Church in 1967. George Ann Thomas is proud of her civil rights work. She is not so proud of where she finds the country today.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to me. I really believe the hype. What was the hype? The hype was if we march, there will be a change. The hype was if we went to school and we became educated, that white America would say, oh, look, see, it's not what they thought. If we integrated, you could see how we were people, too.
George Ann stayed in Atlanta. She is now a humanities professor at Clark Atlanta University. And a few years ago, she created a documentary about her classmates' activism. It's called Foot Soldiers, Class of 1964.
And I'm trying to say, but why we can't be friends? I wrote a song. It's on YouTube. Can't we be friends? Can't we be friends? What happened to that? What happened to friendship? What happened to that?
What happened to friendship? Are we all cross? What happened to friendship? Are we all lost?
It's Professor George Ann Thomas. She's a professor of humanities at Clark Atlanta University, and that song is from her documentary about her classmates' activism called Foot Soldiers, Class of 1964. Well, today on this Martin Luther King Day, we will be talking with Atlantans about their city, about the role Atlanta played in the past, in the present, and the role it will play in the future in America's pursuit for civil rights, and how that has changed over time. So joining us now is Charles Black. In the 1960s, he was a student at Morehouse College and chairman of the Atlanta student movement. Today, he's an actor and sits on several boards as well. Charles Black, welcome to On Point.
My pleasure.
Mr. Black, will you tell us first about your story of arriving in Atlanta? When was it?
Well, I came to Atlanta from Miami, Florida. I lived in the area called Liberty City. And my experience there was one of growing up in an intact family with a mother and father and three siblings. We had dinner at 6 every day. My school experience was strictly segregated. All blacks went to schools that were totally segregated. And there was not a college in the city of Miami that I could attend because of race. So I came to Atlanta to attend Morehouse College in 1958. And the thing that shocked me the most, we came on the train as we traveled, mostly in those days, except for buses. And I saw, in entering Atlanta, on the side of a building, the painting of a large Confederate flag. Mm-hmm. And I'd never seen a Confederate flag on display in Miami. So that was a shock to me. I also saw things that I'd never seen before here, like brick buildings. There were some brick sidewalks and that sort of thing. So I kind of felt like I was stepping back in time. But I know now that Atlanta was a much more progressive place in many respects, even than Miami. But most of the things were the same in terms of race. We had buses in Miami that had signs that said, whites seat from front, coloreds seat from rear. And you knew your place. And you rode in jitneys, as George Ann had mentioned. And when I arrived in Atlanta, I was pleased to be at a place like Morehouse College in the center of the Atlanta University Center, where there was Spelman College, you know, slightly to our south, and there was Clark College to our east. And up the road a little bit, there was Morris Brown College, Atlanta University, and the Interdenominational Theological Center. And there was a strong intellectualism that we witnessed there. Dr. Benjamin E. Mays was president of Morehouse College at the time. Mm-hmm. And we had chapel every day, except Saturday. And he brought in speakers from all over the country of renown, some of them Morehouse men, but others of great note, like the inventor of the polio vaccine, the Masters and Johnson's sex therapist, the guy that wrote the book Cry the Beloved Country about South Africa. And Dr. Mays himself spoke to us once a week.
Right.
So we were inspired by this great intellectualism that we experienced. Plus, we had
Sorry, Mr. Black. Forgive me for interrupting you. We just got about a minute and a half before we have to take our first break, so I want to flag that briefly here. But also, your mention of Dr. Mays is really very, very, very important, right? Because he's credited as like laying the intellectual foundation, right, for the civil rights movement. So can you tell me then a little bit more about how that intellectual foundation that you were introduced to at Morehouse then transformed into activism for you? And we've got about a minute before that first break again.
Okay. The professors that we had were top quality professors who were available to us because they could not teach in white institutions. So Dr. Mays and all the top faculty were folk who inspired us greatly, not only telling us that we could be better and we could be the greatest, but they showed us by their own examples. And so we were inspired thusly. But we were also inspired by Dr. Mays, who wrote a book called Born to Rebel. We talked also about A. Philip Randolph, who of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and people of that ilk, all of whom inspired us to move forward and be better and strive for equality.
Well, we are talking today about the role the city of Atlanta has played, is playing, and will play in America's struggle towards civil rights. So, Charles Black, stand by. I want to hear a lot more stories when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the city of Atlanta and its role, past, present, and future, in America's struggle for civil rights. I'm joined today by Charles Black. He is an alum of Morehouse College, and he's a civil rights movement activist, former chairman of the Atlanta Student Movement, and he joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Black, you know, you made a really important point earlier in the show, and I just want to underscore it, that especially on this day when we're honoring Dr. King, but Atlanta was so much more than Dr. King. I mean, you were talking about the constellation of Black colleges and universities there that really were the fertile soil in which Black intellectualism, civil rights leadership, and then even strategies to activism were grown. And you can't really imagine the American civil rights movement without that whole group of people. I was thinking about how at your alma mater, Morehouse, there was Julian Bond, Joseph Pierce, Lonnie King, etc. So I think that's a really important point to make. And can you just tell me more about then how you became part, of that entire movement that was coming out of Atlanta?
Well, we were inspired by what had happened in Greensboro, North Carolina, when the four guys sat in at a lunch counter there. Lonnie King, Joe Pierce, and Julian Bond were in the little corner drugstore called Yates and Milton when Lonnie approached Julian with Joe Pierce and said, "Have you seen this?" Talking about what had happened there. "And don't you think we ought to do this here?" And they talked to other students that were assembled in the drugstore, the lunch counters and the like. And he met me on campus after leaving there and invited me to a meeting in the Sale Hall Annex on Morehouse College's campus. And we met 18 to 24 or so of us that night and planned to begin such a movement here in Atlanta. Lonnie had asked those who were present who were not prepared to do what we were talking about doing in a nonviolent way, just not to talk about it, going about their business. Well, someone did talk, and it got back to the presidents of the schools, and they called some of us in, and most of them tried to talk us out of it. But one of the presidents finally said, "I agree with the students that they are right." And so the president of Atlanta University, Dr. Clement, said at the time that if you're going to do this, at least let the world know why you're doing what you're doing. And that led to the publication of a document called An Appeal for Human Rights, written essentially by Dr. Rosalind Pope, who's president of the Spelman College student body at the time. That document was published as a full-page ad in the Atlanta Journal and Constitution and the Atlanta Daily World, the black paper. And it was picked up and run free of charge in the New York Times as a full-page ad, and also in a Los Angeles Times. It was read into the Congressional Record by Senator Jacob Javits of New York. That document set forth all of our areas of discontent throughout society, and included education, law enforcement, economics, public accommodations, etc.
Right.
And it became pretty much a blueprint for our movement. We took on all of those issues, and succeeded in many respects with all of them.
So can you tell me more then about actions that were taken inside of Atlanta itself? A downtown boycott?
Yes. Well, we were boycotting. Our initial sit-ins involved 11 locations at 11 o'clock on the morning of March 15, 1960. They included places, public places like City Hall, County Courthouse, State Capitol, but also train stations, bus stations, and 5 and 10 stores and department stores. When our resources in terms of personnel were lacked, we targeted Rich's department store as our main target because it was everybody's favorite store. They had a policy that no sale is ever complete until the customer is satisfied, and they lived by that. If you bought an item there today and 10 years, 15 years later, it didn't work, you didn't like it, didn't want it, you could take it back and they will refund your money or replace that item. So everybody loved Rich's. So we knew that if Rich's fell, you know, everybody else would fall too. Our boycott lasted for a full year before we were able to reach an agreement with them. And Rich's department store lost $10 million over the Christmas holidays, the equivalent of about $500 million in today's money.
Wow. But that you were, was that also when you were first arrested?
Yes, I was arrested at the terminal train station along with Martin Luther King Jr.'s brother and about two dozen other students. And we were sentenced to 10 days in the city farm where we were awakened at 4:30 in the morning. And the guys were taken out to the collard green field to chop weeds, and the girls sat on the outside on the ground to peel potatoes. After the public outcry, we were out in 4 days rather than the 10 that we were sentenced to. So that was my first arrest. The terminal train station was also my first point of arrival in Atlanta because I came on the train and it was at that station that I disembarked.
And just and forgive me because I actually don't know the details of as many of the key moments in the civil rights history that you're sharing, as I should. So I'm asking for your forgiveness. But was Dr. King involved in that downtown boycott you were talking about?
Well, that's a very important question to raise, because Dr. King had entered an agreement with his family and the established black community in Atlanta that he would not be involved in the Atlanta civil rights activism.
Uh-huh.
You know, their point was, you know, you do that Alabama stuff and Albany, Georgia, and all that, but we got this, you know, was the attitude of especially the leading ministers, you know, who had the big congregations and all that, and had done a lot of things in years past, you know, to further the cause of equality. So they didn't need Junior, because, you know, we got, you know, two dozen of us can do what he can do. And he'd agreed to that. And it was not until October the 19th, 2 weeks before the presidential election, by the way, that King was talked into going to Rich's department store and getting arrested, because our boycott had been going on since March, you know, of that year. And there was some chance that it might be waning a little bit. So we needed a spark, like the arrest of King. Now, King had previously been arrested for driving a Georgia automobile while he still had his Alabama driver's license. The pretext, of course, was that Lillian Smith, the white female author, Strange Fruit, was riding in the front seat with him. His wife was in the back. And that's why he was actually stopped, and they had to have some reason for giving him a ticket or whatever. So he was tried in the DeKalb County Courthouse and sentenced to 4 months at the notorious Reedsville Prison, where guards were known to allow prisoners to fight to the death, or they themselves would beat folk to death and all that. So he was taken down there in the middle of the night, like 3 o'clock in the morning, in a paddy wagon with a German Shepherd dog loose in the back with him. And he said himself later that was the most afraid he had ever been in his life. And while King was in jail, it became a national and international disgrace. And as I mentioned, this was 2 weeks before the presidential election between Kennedy and Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon was leading by double digits all over the country. And while his campaign and the Kennedy campaign were trying to decide what, if anything, they should do to intervene in this matter, the Kennedy folk agreed that, you know, Bobby would make a call down to the judge and got the judge to reduce the sentence so that King was released from jail. And the effect of this was that the Kennedy campaign published something they called the Blue Bomb, because it was on blue paper. Then they distributed all over the country in cities that had large black concentrations. And as a result of all this, in this document, this flyer, they quoted Daddy King and Coretta King and Martin and I think Abernathy and maybe one or two others. And they were supporting Kennedy's action in getting ML out of jail. And the result of that was that blacks switched their voting largely from Republicans in honor of FDR to Democrat in large numbers for the first time all over the country. And Kennedy won by less than one vote per precinct nationwide.
Wow.
As a direct result of that action.
Wow. Okay. I'm glad I asked that question, right? Never be afraid to expose one's ignorance in order to learn. Well, Mr. Black, hang on here for just a second, because we do have a little bit of tape of Dr. King speaking about the city of Atlanta. This is from a 1965 Nobel Prize recognition dinner that was held for him in Atlanta. And he talked about what would be required to end racism in the South and why the South should follow Atlanta's lead.
Unfortunately, in the past, the leadership of the white South has by and large been in the hands of closed-minded extremists. These persons have gained prominence and power by the dissemination of false ideas and by appealing to the deepest fears and hates of the human mind. But I am convinced that they do not speak for the South. They speak only for a willful and vocal minority. And certainly we are fortunate in Atlanta that we do not have this type of leadership. And I think the leadership of Atlanta Its political leadership as well as its economic leadership must be commended for the great strides that we've made in this community over the last few years.
Dr. Martin Luther King on January 27th, 1965, talking about the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Charles Black, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring Professor Maurice Hobson into the conversation now. Professor Hobson is a professor of African-American studies at Georgia State University and author of The Legend of the Black Mecca, Politics and Class in the Making of Modern Atlanta. Professor Hobson, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm doing well, and thank you so much for listening along as Charles Black told us some incredible stories about Atlanta in the 1960s. What did you hear in what he told us that then helps us understand what Atlanta became in the period that you wrote your book about, especially the 80s and the 90s in Atlanta?
Well, first and foremost, it is always a pleasure to be in the presence of Charles Black. The work that he and his colleagues and comrades were able to do during the 1960s is absolutely amazing. The interesting thing about this, though, is that, you know, Atlanta's rise or image as a black Mecca is based on three things. It's based on historically based on three things. It's based on black education, which Mr. Black laid out in terms of the Atlanta University Center, but then it parlays over into economics, the Sweet Auburn District, which was deemed as the richest black district in the world, and then black political empowerment and electoral politics. And so what was able to happen with this is the actual tarrying that took place in the modern civil rights movement actually does allow for black political empowerment and electoral politics that starts in the 1940s, and it really reaches a fever's pitch after Dr. King's assassination with the election of Maynard Holbrook Jackson Jr. as the city's first black mayor.
And so then Atlanta continues, obviously, to be this place because of, when I say this place of leading civil rights activism. Because of those three things that you talked about, how much of that, of the bringing together of education, economic power, and then political power was were Atlanta activists able to take, you know, elsewhere in the United States?
Well, I would actually challenge that. I actually do challenge the idea. Atlanta is not the cradle of the civil rights movement, and let me take just a few minutes to explain
sure,
why. You know, there's this notion, particularly in how we study civil and human rights in today's society, that has often, how we study it now is we study it from the bottom up instead of the top down. And when we lay out that King was the leader of the movement, it is a straight up top down. It doesn't really include the narratives of women. It doesn't include the narratives of working class folk. There are a lot more players. And I'm sure if Dr. King were alive and with us today, he would tell us that he was one of thousands of leaders of a movement, of this movement. And so, but the thing about that, too, is that the work that has been done in terms of Atlanta, in terms of black education, black economics, black political empowerment, electoral politics, and in today's society, black expressive culture has been great. But what we have to consider is that when we talk about black educated folk and black folk who are able to make, you know, a living, we're talking few and far between. And so we have to give it back to the masses. And one of the things that I articulated in my own research, and we're able to pick this to talk about this, is a concept that I call the Black New South. What the Black New South is it's based on the actual campaigns that take place in the state of Alabama. The campaign that comes out of the Birmingham movement that produces the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which buttresses the 14th Amendment and grants equal protection and due process under the law, i.e. citizenship. And then what happens in Selma, Alabama, which produces the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which gives voting. And so what you have is you have citizenship and voting. And it is with that that we begin to see the idea of full-scale civil and human rights that goes to the black masses. So I do not want us to get confused and believe that, you know, this notion of a black middle class and black upper classes are leading the black masses, because the black masses have a thought about what things are in their lives, too. And so what I try to do in my research is I try to balance it. And we understand that Dr. King is a pivotal part, but so is Dorothy Bolden here in Atlanta. So is Edie Nixon. And so is, you know, you know, other folks like Dorothy Turner out in Austin, Texas. And so we have to give it back to the people. And I don't want us to ever get this idea that it's just about the Black elite and Black middle class. And not to say that anyone produces is saying that, but I just want to give it a little bit more nuance.
Actually, Professor Hobson, I'm thrilled to hear what you're saying, right? Because that's what we're trying to do, trying to, like, sort of, instead of getting that top-down look, like seeing the whole picture in its greater truth. So what you just laid out is absolutely critical to me, and my mind is aflame with more questions here. But Mr. Black, let me just give you 30 seconds before we have to take our next break here. What's your response to what Professor Hobson was just saying?
Well, I'm glad that he mentioned Dorothy Bolden, because Dorothy Bolden organized the Domestic Workers Union, where they were demanding a minimum of $5 a day in car fare for their work. And they were successful in that regard. But the point that I always like to make is that a movement is by its nature multidimensional. It involves a deep commitment to high ideals on the part of a lot of people doing a lot of different things over a long period of time. And that is what the professor's observations reflect.
Well, Charles Black and Professor Maurice Hobson, stand by for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk about how that movement is manifest today. In Atlanta. I'm going to stick with my focus on Atlanta, even with your points about the bigger civil rights movement are well taken, Professor Hobson. So we'll keep bringing those in the last segment of the show. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the city of Atlanta and its role in the past, present, and future in America's struggle for civil rights. I'm joined today by Charles Black. He is an activist then and now, and former chairman of the Atlanta Student Movement. Professor Maurice Hobson joins us as well. He's a professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University and author of The Legend of the Black Mecca, Politics and Class in the Making of Modern Atlanta. So on that modern Atlanta part, let me just play a little quick cut here from Andrew Young, who, of course, was at one time former executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, went on to become mayor of Atlanta for a while, also then went on to be ambassador for the United States to the United Nations. So a really important American. And here he is talking about what makes Atlanta special.
We're really making this a truly modern city, but the key to it was, I think largely with Coca-Cola, they realized that bad race relations was bad for business. And so the business community worked with us so that almost everything we've done since the 1970s has been black and white together, male and female together, rich and poor together, gay and straight together. And anybody that's not in the deal can mess it up. So the key to our success has been helping everybody to be a part of our city.
That's Andrew Young. He was mayor of Atlanta from 1982 to 1990, and that was from an interview he gave in 2016. Professor Hobson, respond to what Andrew Young said there about his view about Atlanta's success.
Well, you know, Ambassador Young, who's a good friend of mine, he's a close friend of mine, he's a mentor in many ways, is absolutely correct. But the seeds of that was actually planted, in particular, by a man by the name of John Wesley Dobbs. John Wesley Dobbs was the highest ranking member of the Prince Hall Masonic Order and the unofficial mayor of the Sweet Auburn District, which was the black district, black business district. And John Wesley Dobbs, in 1946, as a result of the King v. Chapman U.S. Supreme Court case, what John Wesley Dobbs does, along with A.T. Walden, is he creates the Atlanta Negro Voters League, which then delivers or makes black Atlanta extremely important in statewide politics. And he promoted voting. Well, John Wesley Dobbs's protege was his grandson, the Honorable Maynard Holbrook Jackson Jr., who was the city's first black mayor. And it's Maynard Jackson's standard of a gold standard for affirmative action, giving 35% of all contracts to minority contractors. And that included women, that included African-Americans, that included the LGBTQIA community. And it sets a gold standard for the city of Atlanta to be the most inclusive. Well, after Maynard Jackson is mayor from 73 to 81, and Ambassador Andrew Young, who was a UN ambassador under Jimmy Carter, is able to assume the reins as being the city's top administrator, it is Ambassador Young's prowess that is able to truly make Atlanta inclusive, because what it then does is it opens Atlanta up to international business, international black business. Mm. And so with that being said, there is a layer to Andrew Young's conversation that he didn't mention, but I will mention, and that is the internationalization of Atlanta, particularly opening things up to Asia, to the Caribbean, to South America, to Africa, to the Europe, and to the rest of the world to invest in this city and truly make this a global city that is extremely inclusive.
Mm. Well, I want to move forward and talk about then where Atlanta is today. But let's, first of all, in order to do that, go back a little bit, because once again, here's Dr. King in Atlanta on August 16th, 1967, speaking at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
I've also decided to stick with love. But I know that love is ultimately the only answer to mankind's problems. And I'm going to talk about it everywhere I go. I know it isn't popular to talk about it in some circles today. And I'm not talking about emotional bosh when I talk about love. I'm talking about a strong, demanding love. But I have seen too much hate. I've seen too much hate on the faces of sheriffs in the South. I've seen hate on the faces of too many Klansmen and too many white citizens, counselors in the South, to want to hate myself, because every time I see it, I know that it does something to their faces and their personalities. And I say to myself that hate is too great a burden to bear. I have decided to love it.
Dr. King in 1967. So one of the questions I have is how much of that legacy still informs activism coming out of Atlanta today. Well, we spoke with an activist named Yonazda Lone Wolf, and here's why she said she came to Atlanta.
I came here as a student because of the fact that this is the birth city of the civil rights movement. I wanted to be able to sit down and organize and learn from those that walked with Dr. King. Everywhere that Dr. King walked and organized, there are still elders that are still involved. Around the time of voting rights, you know, we're meeting and talking with a lot of these elders that are still in the fight.
Well, joining us now is Ensay Ofat. Ensay's CEO of the New Georgia Project, a nonpartisan effort to register and civically engage Georgia residents. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, thank you.
How would you describe Atlanta's role in the modern civil rights movement today?
I think that Atlanta activists and organizers and ordinary Atlantans are clear about the legacy of civil rights organizing and human rights organizing that we have inherited. And that today what you see is sort of multi-generational movement spaces, multi-generational campaigns that honor the work that has happened, and it very much informs the strategy of today. that young people, young organizers, active organizers are in deep community with veterans. And because we, you know about the history, know about the legacy, are able to innovate on that, I think that it continues to be a cultural center. So a center for cultural organizing that is layered and paired with civil rights and human rights organizing.
Sorry for interrupting, but when you say you're able to innovate on that legacy, can you just tell me a little bit more, a specific example for...
Yeah, absolutely. I think about my organization, the New Georgia Project, where we are building video games. We have a video game that's going to be released this quarter, a voting rights, civil rights video game. We build mobile apps that are designed to demystify how government works, how campaigns and elections work, to explain to people what their voting rights are, to give reminders about voter registration deadlines. And so we use a lot of data and technology. There's not a message that appears in our text messages or that we use on the doors or that we use in phone banks that we haven't tested with the people through focus groups and polling, et cetera. And so, again, because of our deep and close relationship, there's no daylight between us and the movement veterans who we're in community with. We're able to take the things that have worked in the past and innovate on them using data and technology and culture.
Well, Charles Black, let me turn back to you here, and thank you so much for listening so patiently for a while. Today we honor Dr. King. We ought to honestly honor civil rights activists every day, but today we put a name on it. But I also don't – I want to resist the urge to have this be too rose-colored because, I mean, in a sense, we're still here with the need for civil rights activism, right? The nation has not yet achieved the vision that Dr. King laid out. And also, beneath the surface, are there some feelings of differences between different generations of activists, even in Atlanta? And I ask this question because in the summer of 2020, we spoke with Reverend Jesse Jackson. And at that time, he used a phrase which I have not been able to get out of my mind. And I don't think it applies to Ensei's work. But more broadly, he said that activists of today, they're focused on, when we were talking about efforts to defund the police, for example, the Reverend Jackson said people are focused on what he called the epidermis of America, they need to get down into what he called the marrow, really the marrow. And that was political power. So... do you see a difference between the generations, Mr. Black?
Yes, but before we leave the rose, I have to take a bow to my idol, Ensei. She and I serve on a board together, which underscores the synergy between veterans and current day activists. And that board is Freedom University. I chair that board. And our mission is to help undocumented students get into the best colleges and universities in the country, partly because our state excludes them from three of our top universities here in the state. We'll accept their tax dollars, but because they were brought in as kids or whatever by their parents long ago who were escaping death and deprivation and all kinds of things like that, they are denied the opportunity that is inherent in our being human, a right to education among them. But anyhow, with respect to the point that Reverend Jackson was making, I'm not sure that there is as much of a disconnect between the current generation and the veterans. It's just that it takes time for your maturation to get to the point of realizing that there is, in fact, marrow beneath the epidermis. And the one point that I must make is that all of this relates to economic deprivation.
Right.
Dr. King, a year before his death, when he was at the Riverside Church in New York, talked about the triple evils of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. We still have such a divide economically in this country and around the world to the extent that the top 1/10 or 1% has wealth equal to about half the wealth of the world, and there's something wrong with that picture. I think it was Du Bois who talked about the book, The Ballad and the Buck. The professor can correct me on the source. And, you know, the book, get your education. The ballot, you got to get in there and vote. But the buck, we have to stop financing our own oppression, which means that we have to stop buying from those people who support those who oppress us. You know, there are a lot of big dollar stores and organizations and all that who put money into the pockets of the extreme right wing bigots who make the laws and end up in the judgeships and all of that. And we continue to support them because often we don't make the connection. So we have to learn to stop, you know, financing our own oppression. And that's getting down to the marrow of the issue.
Yeah. Well, Professor Hobson, let me turn back to you. We've just got a couple minutes left, so I'm just going to be sure to try to save some time for NSA to have the last word here today. But I was thinking, you know, that there may be some listeners out there who are still who still think back to the, you know, that surge of activism that took place, that wave across the country in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, and are wondering if there is a different kind of activism today, one that doesn't see marching and civil disobedience as adequate enough, that in the words of one activist out of Atlanta, that there more heat needs to be brought to protest. And I wanted to know what you thought about that.
Well, I certainly think that. So first and foremost, let me say this. You know, when Atlanta erupted in 2020 as a result of pandemic and protest, I mean, you know, it's not just George Floyd. It's Breonna Taylor, who was murdered in Kentucky. And, you know, Rayshard Brooks is Philando Castile. I mean, there's been a longstanding kind of conversation about this. I mean, across the South, I've even in my own family, I've experienced where the police have used, you know, brute force and killed a cousin of mine. But with this being said, there is somewhat of a disconnect between younger and older. And I'll give you an example of this. One of the reasons I do civil rights work is when I was 17 years old, Outkast and Goody Mob out of Atlanta had a song called Get Up, Get Out and Get Something. And they publicly call out Maynard Jackson, who was in his third term. And they called him Crooked Jackson, got the whole country thinking that my city's the big lick for 96. And what they were really talking about is what I call in my research the Olympification of Atlanta. Urban renewal, gentrification, neoliberalism, political economy, racial uplift theory, and how Atlanta was being presented as this place for black folk, but then how it's missing the masses. And as a result of that, the thing about it is now that we're in our mid-40s, mid to late 40s, we're all more leaning into this notion of understanding what Maynard Jackson did and understanding that when Outkast and Goody Mob did that, they were being critical of King's generation. They were being critical of an older generation. And now we're being criticized by millennials and Generation Z. But with this, Atlanta, when people were saying, well, we didn't believe Atlanta would explode. And I'm like, I don't understand why you don't, because there have been explosions before, 66, 67. In 68, Atlanta didn't explode after Dr. King's assassination, but that was because of respect for Dr. King's idea of love and nonviolent direct action. But I want to say this just really quickly. And several years ago, Ambassador Andrew Young got into a little bit of a tussle with Black Lives Matter, and the young people were called unlovable brats. And the thing about this is that was clearly a conversation around generational gaps. There needed to be generational dialogue. And where I sit right now is I am the bridge between an Ambassador Young's generation or Mr. Black's generation and the young folks on the ground, because I'm in that sweet spot to where I understand both sides. And the beauty of it is this, is if the elders hear what the young people have to say and the young people hear the wisdom of the elders, I think we can come to a happy medium.
Well, young people like Ensei, and Ensei, I have to just apologize to you personally because I am out of time and I wanted to give you a chance to have a last word here, but maybe instead what we'll do is we'll have you back sometime. So Ensei Ufot, CEO of the New Georgia Project, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And Professor Maurice Hobson, professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University and author of The Legend of the Black Mecca. Professor Hobson, thank you so very much.
Absolutely.
And Charles Black, civil rights movement activist, former chairman of the Atlanta Student Movement. It's been such a pleasure to have you, Mr. Black. Thank you so much.
My high honor.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.